This is the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau, and today we're talking about getting rid of allergens in your home so you and your loved ones can breathe easier. With us today is Robin Wilson. She owns a nationally recognized eco-friendly lifestyle brand and she is an interior designer. She has 20 years of experience advocating for clean construction and design methods through her firm, Robin Wilson Home. She's also the author of two really nice books on this subject. Do you think your allergies or asthma is caused by your home or the things in it? What would you like to know about how to breathe easier when you're there? Well, we'd like you to be part of the conversation, so give us a call, 800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Robin, welcome back.
How are you doing?
I am doing really, really well. How about yourself?
Very good. It's so cold here as we approach spring. I hope everyone is thinking about things they can do now for a wonderful non-wheezing and sneezing spring.
Absolutely. And we're just getting over a very, very cold spell. And today it might get 50 down in the southern part of the state. It's, you know, like spring here. So.
Oh, my goodness.
I know. It's been a crazy year. So before we start getting into the nitty-gritty here, why don't you give us a definition of clean design?
Well, I believe that everyone has the propensity to wheeze and sneeze if their house is not clean.
Right.
And also if the building materials in their home is not clean. And so what we try to do is guide people from the foundation to the furnishings on simple things that they can do to make sure that their home is a healthy space for their family.
So what are some of the advantages of this type of design that people may not always recognize?
Well, the simple tip is recognizing that walls are actually the biggest surface in your house. Most people would say floors, but walls are the biggest surface. So what paint are you putting on your walls? It should be no VOC, which means that it's not off-gassing. And also, you should be dusting those walls every once in a while. And that's a simple thing to do to keep your home clean.
Yeah, I'm really bad at that, Robin. I don't think about it. You know, we don't think there's dust, though, right? Especially if you've got textured walls. Oh, my gosh, I'm bad. I'm going to have to go home and do that right away.
Well, I also tell people that we spend one-third of our life sleeping.
Yes.
And we actually have something we call the rule of threes. And mm-hmm. The rule of threes is to ask someone first, when was the last time you washed or replaced your pillow? And most people start to grimace because they realize it's been 6 years, sometimes even longer.
Ouch.
I know. And so when we tell people that, we also then remind them that a simple pillow test is try to fold your pillow in half. If it bounces back, you're in good shape. If it stays in place, it probably weighs more now than when you bought it.
Ew. Okay. Thank you. Let's not go into details, but why?
Exactly. So then we go to the rule of threes, and this is a simple clean design home tip. Every 3 weeks, you should wash the zippered pillowcase that's over your pillow.
Mm-hmm.
Every month, or 3 months, you should wash the actual pillow if it's a down alternative pillow. If it's a feather pillow, you might take it outside and I guess they shake it or something of that nature. Although I do recommend down alternative pillows. And then on an every 3 year basis, if you haven't done all those things, you should replace your pillow.
Yes, absolutely. And I'll have you know that I just washed mine like 2 weeks ago. I feel so proud of myself. It's like I flossed when I went to the dentist, right? It's the same thing.
That's right. So if you think about clean design, it's wellness for your lifestyle.
Mm-hmm.
It's simple things that you can do to improve your life and your family's life without spending a lot of money. And especially as we go into the spring season, sometimes people don't realize that they need to also check around their home in every room, even the unused rooms. Was there any water penetration into their space? And if there was, find out where it's coming from. Is it from the roof? Is it from the gutters being clogged? Those are some simple things you could do right now as everything is thawing out.
And because that moisture can create mold, right?
That's correct. And mold is something that can then trigger allergens or asthma conditions, mm-hmm. which become chronic conditions for your life.
Yes, for sure. Well, we've got a call from Angela in Partyville. Go ahead, Angela. What question do you have?
Hi, I have a comment and a question.
Okay.
We moved into a new home in 2019, and the previous owners had four pets. And I used to have chronic sore throat, nasal congestion in the fall and the spring. But after we moved in, I started having it year round. And I finally got my ducts cleaned, and that resolved it. I no longer had the issues. My question is, I'm noticing lately that the toilet paper that we use, and I've tried three different brands, so that creates like this little dust. And is there anything that you recommend about that or a type of toilet paper?
Yes, I've noticed that, my two, Angela. It's annoying.
Well, I wish I could go to the toilet paper manufacturers and tell them to stop doing whatever they're doing, but I have noticed it too. So the only thing that I tell people now is use a microfiber cloth, or I don't want to advocate for any particular brand, but do a quick dust up every day in your bathroom area where that dust does fly around.
Yeah, and think about, it's not really popular in the United States, but it's getting there. Think about a bidet, Angela. Less waste with paper and dust. So
exactly.
Yeah,
but some bathrooms, if they don't have the space for a bidet, mm-hmm. there is, and especially if you're in Wisconsin, Kohler is an amazing company. They actually have a new toilet seat version, and you can retrofit your toilet. You'll have to have a plug back there. But you can retrofit your toilet seat to become a bidet seat.
Yeah, I have a friend who just put one in, and he loves it, and it wasn't too bad to fit it in. So something to look into for sure. So when it comes to the things in our house, what are some of the areas that can easily be made, eco-friendly?
Well, the first place to think about is, it's funny, your bathroom. since we're on that subject, I love Kohler products. I recommend them because they have something called WaterSense, and that means that it's minimal water usage, that they have filtration systems to actually manage the flow from your shower. And of course, they have toilets that have two buttons or two settings, one for a larger flush and one for a smaller flush. The other thing that I think is critically important in an eco-conscious or eco-friendly bathroom is making sure that the backer board, and that's something most people don't think about unless they fully renovate a bathroom, that the backer board will prevent mold growth. And if you have wallpaper in your bathroom, take it down today.
Okay, why?
when you take it down, you will likely see mold growing behind it.
I see what you're saying. I actually just changed out the wallpaper in my bathroom, and it was fine. So I guess we're okay, right?
Yeah, I hope so.
Well,
the other thing, and clean design home is sold at major retailers. We actually have a towel line that we have sold. And it's sold at Macy's and Belk and Wayfair and HSN. Our towels are made of what they call long strand cotton. And that means that it doesn't lint as much as some of the lesser towels. Mm-hmm. And remember, just like your caller said, lint attracts dust. Dust attracts, dust mites. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, then you have the allergic and allergy triggers. So I do recommend a long strand cotton towel. And Clean Design Home is one to consider.
Okay. Now, we're talking about healthy air and breathing today on the show. And one way, you can help your house is air with an air purifier, right?
Well, true, but most people forget to change the filter.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. You think it's like plug it in and go. But it doesn't work if it's not.
It doesn't work that way.
Yeah.
So please, if you do get an air purifier, change the filter on a seasonal basis, if not more frequently. And then also consider plants. Most people, if you Google right now, you'll find that Dracaena plants mm-hmm. and corn cane plants are some of the highest ranked plants for actually removing formaldehyde and chemicals from the air.
Right. There's a number of plants that I think, was it NASA that did the testing not too long ago? There's a whole list out there that will help you with that.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. A Dracaena plant will filter 90% of toxins in a 100 square foot space.
That is incredible. And they're not that expensive, so it can't hurt, right?
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
Well, tell us about the air purifiers themselves. What types are available?
There's so many, and I don't like to advocate for a particular brand.
Okay.
But I will say this. I have one at my home that indicates if there's a toxin in the air, and it glows a different color.
Wow.
And then it automatically increases its power. Like if you bring a candle, a scented candle into the room, within a minute, it will detect that emission and will rev its engine up and start to try to remove that toxin from the air.
Mm-hmm.
I don't spend the $9. Be prepared to spend more money
okay.
than $9. If someone says it's $9, it's not a real air purifier. Mm-hmm. Make sure it has a HEPA filter.
Okay.
Make sure that you're able to change it and clean it. And also make sure you have a HEPA filter vacuum. Because otherwise you'll vacuum, and you remember probably at your grandmother's house, you'd vacuum and you'd see the dust clouds flying behind the vacuum.
Oh, yes.
You don't want that to happen.
No.
It's just defeating.
And there's filters in there that have to be cleaned too, right, in your vacuum cleaner?
In the vacuum cleaner, there are filters as well as your air purifier. And so, again, I do it on a seasonal basis. I clean the actual interior of the air filter mm-hmm. System on my vacuum and also on the air purifier. So there's a day when things are laying out on the countertop or in the mudroom.
Right. I've done that. Yeah, you have to make sure it dries out. So
that's
yeah,
right.
Yeah, for sure. So where's the best place to put an air purifier in your home? I've always wondered about that.
I actually suggest putting it in places where you congregate frequently. That can be a bedroom, a living room, and of course, if you have children, a nursery or play space.
Okay. And some of them can be, they're kind of, you know, unattractive.
Mm-hmm.
Have you come up with ways to make them look better?
You know, I actually found that having it out, given what I do, is a great conversation starter.
That's
so
true.
I actually leave mine out. It also reminds me to clean it.
Oh, yeah. That's a very good point, because otherwise you kind of forget about it until maybe your allergies start kicking in.
Right.
Yeah.
Now, another thing that we also forget about are our heater filters or HVAC system filters.
Mm-hmm.
Some people have a monoflow system where water runs through pipes within the wall. I suggest that every couple of years you change that water. During the off season, it's just sitting there. Potential mold growth could occur.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you turn it on, potentially you're letting those spores. Remember, mold is spores. And as it circulates, maybe you could affect yourself in the first couple of days of turning on your heat. But if you have a regular HVAC system that blows air, I would suggest, even though they say change it every season or maybe every 6 weeks, I would say change your filter on a monthly basis.
Okay. Now, what about those ducts that, you know, our caller earlier had mentioned she had those cleaned? Do you agree with her that they should be cleaned periodically?
I do, but I also say that sometimes cleaning your ducts, it's not going to help.
Mm-hmm.
It depends on the system. Do you have a, what they call I don't want to call it plastic, but do you have a metal or stainless steel piping system? Do you have a PVC piping system? Do you have a corrugated metal piping system? It depends on what's going on in your HVAC system. And duct can sometimes look very dirty at the surface, but there's stuff deep, deep in there. So make sure that they're using an extension vacuum and not just at the surface.
Yeah, that makes sense. Now, it's like I said, today is nice here. And maybe some people are going to think about opening their windows. Is that good or bad for people who maybe are suffering from allergies or what have you?
I think that everyone, if it's not too cold, if you can open your windows for between 1 and 5 minutes, at least one window in the house, 1 to 5 minutes a day, and let some fresh air in, you're doing a service to yourself.
Oh, great.
A lot of homes today are hermetically sealed, meaning we seal them as much as we can from outside, whereas older homes, they were breathing a little bit, to be polite. If you think about the oven cleaner, the bathroom cleaner, the air freshener type things, and scented candles and any other number of chemicals we place in our home, if we don't let it air out every day, every week, we potentially are creating a chemical overload in our homes.
That makes total sense. We do have a call. Dale and Baldwin, go right ahead with your question.
Hi, thank you so much for taking my call. Proud new grandparents and admire how protective our daughter is of our 19-month-old grandbaby. The question is with bath toys, the ones that you can squeeze in and out. Of course, she loves to squeeze for get bubbles and then squeeze the water back up. But we notice that there are often pieces of mold, you know, when we do that. So wondering about concern for that, how best to clean those toys.
Great question, Dale. What do you think, Robin?
That's the best question ever. I have I remember when my daughter was young, I went to a seminar about wellness for children's toys. And the physicians there said, throw them all out. I said, oh, my gosh, I have these great squeaky toys that are distracting in the bath. And they said, throw them all out. But before you do, cut them open and see what's inside. After cutting open two of them, I threw them all out.
Oh, dear.
So the first thing to tell you is those are really cute little toys, but they have openings inside which allow them to float and make that squeaky noise. And unless you are extremely rigorous about cleaning them every single day or every single time they're wet, they will begin to harbor bacteria and mold.
Okay, Dale, congratulations on being a grandparent, but yeah, you're going to break your little kid's heart by throwing them away.
Yes. Get the rubber duck that doesn't have a hole in it. How
there you
that?
Go. Yeah. Yeah. Forget about the squeakiness. Leave those for the dogs. Thanks for the call, Dale. Deb emailed us, and she wanted you to spell the name of the plant that you mentioned earlier as the number one best cleaning for indoor air. It's Dracaena.
Sure.
Dracaena, right?
Yes, it's Dracaena. Mm-hmm. And also the corn cane plant does formaldehyde removal.
Mm-hmm. Both very readily available pretty much anywhere. So very easy to find. So thanks for that question, Deb. Vivian emailed. We were talking earlier about the toilet paper dust. She says you can keep your toilet paper off its hanger and just unroll it by hand, and that seems to create less dust.
Okay.
Yeah, that's it drives me crazy when it's not on the roll, but yeah, that's a good idea.
The only problem with that, I tell her, is going back to Dale having a 19-month-old, you do that and you might end up with a toilet paper party in the bathroom.
Or a pet, too. Yeah, yeah. You know, going back, we had mentioned candles a couple times. Now, I've heard things in the past about candles not being the greatest thing to be lighting in your home, and scented candles in particular. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I do believe that you should buy what I call a higher quality candle. The reason for that is they will typically have a cotton wick. They will not have any type of metals or otherwise within that wick, or that they will have a soy face wax with a blend so it doesn't smoke as much. And also, they will not use hugely synthetic fragrances. They'll use essential oils instead.
Okay.
You do not want a petroleum-based candle in your home. You want beeswax or soy wax, and I recommend soy wax mix. The other thing is, when you trim the wick, make it very short, you will have less smoke, typically,
mm-hmm.
if you take a very long wick.
Okay, great. Well, thank you for that. Before we let you go, you've got a big announcement to share with us about your business. What's new here?
Well, please tune in to HSN on February the 7th at 2 p.m. and also on the 8th at 10 a.m. I will be on HSN, and we will be doing something for the top of bed. And pillows.
Oh, nice. Now, that's the Home Shopping Network, for those of you who aren't familiar with HSN.
Home Shopping Network.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
It's a one-hour segment, and you can also go onto their website right now and type in Clean Design Home by Robin Wilson or just my name.
Okay.
And buy a few things right now.
Wonderful. And for people who have, you know, allergy problems with them or their family, it's really nice to know that you understand, right?
I grew up a pan-allergic child, which means food, pet dander, smoke, dust, almost like the bubble child, right? And my mom thankfully found, we had a regular pediatrician, but there was a holistic pediatrician that she went to. I guess euphemistically you would call it a hippie doctor. But I almost say it's like the Patch Adams. He wore a Hawaiian shirt. He had a ponytail. But this particular doctor said, you can raise a strong child or you can raise a child on strong medicine. His entire philosophy was about mitigating any triggers for allergic and asthmatic symptoms. In my book, Clean Design, Wellness for Your Lifestyle, we outline many of those options. It includes getting rid of shag carpet if you still have it. That was a big deal in the 70s.
Oh, yeah.
And then, of course, if your pet is inside, make sure they're clean. And the foods that we all eat, and as we talked earlier about, if your gutters are not clean, you want to make sure they're clean so water doesn't start to get into the walls, which can create a mold issue.
Mm-hmm. Wonderful. Well, thank you so much, Robin. We really appreciate you taking time out of your extremely busy schedule to be with, and hopefully we won't wait as long to kind of have you back again.
I very appreciated, and stay warm this spring and summer, I hope,
okay.
In your area.
You too. Thank you.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Robin Wilson is a nationally recognized eco-friendly lifestyle brand owner and an interior designer, and she has 20 years of experience advocating for clean construction and design methods through her firm, Robin Wilson Home. And we'll be back in just a bit to talk about radon. Well, radon is a radioactive gas that's colorless and odorless, and it can make its way into your home, and if it does, it can have some very serious health effects. Hi, I'm Jill Nadeau, and today we're talking about testing your home for radon. Michelle Schwack is here to talk to us about radon. She's an environmental health sanitarian with the Marathon County Health Department. And we'd like to hear from you. Did you find radon in your home? What was your experience like? Maybe what do you want to know about testing process? Give us a call, 800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Michelle, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you for having me.
I love your title, Environmental Health Sanitarian. It sounds like you should have your own comic book.
Yeah, it's another way of saying health inspector.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But a nicer way. I like it. So, let's talk about radon. Where does it come from?
Well, radon comes from the breakdown of uranium that's found in trace amounts in certain granite formations. So it really comes from deposits in our soil, below our homes, below our businesses, below our schools. And if you have a source that is putting out radon, you may be at risk of having it in your home.
So I would think by your description that we in Wisconsin probably have some pretty high levels of radon. Is that right?
Right, right. So I represent Marathon County, but there are, you know, in our area, we have what's called granite peaks. So we have very close to the surface outcroppings of granite here that unfortunately contains trace amounts of uranium that breaks down over time into radon gas. But if you go to certain areas like the La Crosse area where they have granite bluffs along the Mississippi River, et cetera, they don't have the deposits of uranium, so they don't have the high levels of radon like we have here in central Wisconsin.
Okay. So why should we be concerned about this, you know, gas we can't see or smell?
Yeah, that's a great question, because we're all about public health at the local health departments. And the reason that we need to be concerned about this is exposure to radon gas is the leading cause of lung cancer among non-smokers.
Oh, my gosh. That is something to be concerned about.
Yeah,
for sure.
Yes. Yeah. And if you smoke and you're exposed to radon at the same time, your risk of developing lung cancer is 10 times greater.
Wow. Wow.
Yes.
Now, who should be considering testing for radon then? All of us?
Everyone.
Okay.
Everyone.
And what if
testing is really, it's very simple and it's very inexpensive. And, you know, it gives you kind of a snapshot of where are your radon levels at. Mm-hmm. And it helps us to determine what are your next courses of action. Should you do additional testing or should you consider mitigation? Or should you just wait and test again in a couple of years to ensure that your levels stay low?
Okay. And what about if you're renting? Is that your responsibility or the landlord's?
Well, it's not really anyone's responsibility. The thing to remember is that in the state of Wisconsin, radon is not regulated. You know, in a world where everything seems to be regulated, radon
right.
in Wisconsin is not regulated.
Hmm.
So there's nothing that says that the landlord, if they're renting a property, has to do any testing, or if they do testing, that they even have to fix the problem. So as a tenant, you know, for under $10, you can get a short-term test. You can find out what your radon levels are at. It would be great to inform your property owner, but again, they don't have to do anything to fix the problem. But what it does is it arms you as a tenant to say, you know what, I know enough about radon that radon exposure is not great for me, and I'm going to start looking for another place to rent.
Yeah, that totally makes sense. Now, what about if, I would assume this comes through the basement, right?
Right?
What if you don't have a basement, or maybe your home is like brand new and the basement's in great shape?
Yeah. Radon can penetrate through any surface that's in contact with the soil.
Okay.
So whether you have a basement or you have a slab at grade or you even have a mobile home where you have skirting around between the mobile home and the soil, that is enough to contain the radon gas and allow it to be drawn into the building.
Okay. Oh, you have a question from Isaac in Wausau, which kind of relates to this. Go ahead, Isaac.
Hey, just a quick thing. I really like the subject of radon since it's so prevalent around here. So cool that we're talking about it. I've seen on a few new build houses, they come with an active radon mitigation system built in already, you know, with the fan and all that stuff, subslab. But we've found it to not be super effective in many cases because they don't actually dig the pit under the slab. They just stick the PVC into the soil and then pour the slab around it. So I just kind of wanted to bring that up, that even if you have an active radon system in a new house, you probably want to get it tested. You know, like I said, I really like the Wave radon monitor thing that you can buy. It's like $100 or something. Works great. Then you can actively monitor it all the time. But we've seen some pretty high numbers on those, basically since they haven't been installed correctly. So, yeah, just wanted to mention that.
Great. Thank you, Isaac. What do you think about that, Michelle?
Well, you know, keeping in mind, again, that radon is not regulated. So nobody is watching the installation of these systems going in or inspecting them at the time that they're installed. So, you know, we always recommend using a certified professional for both measurement and mitigation for radon. Because of that reason, we can get people who are installing systems inappropriately, not following protocol, not understanding the science behind it, where you can get misinstallations, kind of like Isaac has stated. You know, it's always a good idea to check your system, check your radon levels. Like I said, it's less than $10 through the health department to get a radon test kit, to put it in place just to give you some peace of mind that your radon levels are low, even mm-hmm. if you have a home that does have a mitigation system in it.
Great. Okay. Thank you, Isaac, for that. We appreciate it. Is there a best time to test for radon?
Yeah, we like to call them affectionately the heating months. Okay, so in Wisconsin, that tends to be a little bit longer than in some other states.
Yes, it is.
but once we close up our homes and we start running our furnace, that's the real ideal time to doing the testing. All winter long, you're going to get what's called the worst case scenario as your test results go. We know that radon fluctuates with the seasons, that it increases in the indoor environment through the winter or the heating months, and then decreases in the indoor environment through the summer when we have more in and out traffic, our windows are open, the house isn't sealed up nice and tight like it is through the winter time.
Yeah, that makes sense.
So the best time to test is during those heating months.
Okay. So walk us through how the test works.
So it's a charcoal-based test that absorbs the radioactive particles from the radon. And then that test kit is mailed to a laboratory in Texas, and it's analyzed. And then you actually tell them how you want the results reported to you, if you want them reported through email or send a snail mail copy. You can even still get a fax if you want it.
Wow.
So you actually tell them how you want to receive those results. And usually it takes 7 to 10 days to get results back.
And will they tell you then with those results what that means for you?
They will provide a little bit of guidance along with the test results when you get them. But as the Radon Information Center, and we're one of 17 Radon Information Centers in the state of Wisconsin, ours is the largest. We cover 11 counties, pretty much the whole northeast quadrant of the state of Wisconsin. So what happens is we get a report, monthly report of all the test results that were done in our Radon Information area in those 11 counties. And as the Radon Information Center, we send out letters to people who have a short-term result, a short-term test result between 4 and 8. They get one type of letter, and if they had a short-term result greater than 8, they get another type of letter. So they are going to get communication in our service area from the RIC, the Radon Information Center, stating what your next course of action should be.
Okay, great. So you don't have to be that "quote unquote" smart about what's going on, because people are there to help you, like you.
Exactly, and we've worked really hard to educate our constituents in the counties that we serve, to arm them with the information that they need to handle some very basic questions about testing, where to place my kit, etc. And then with the knowledge that if there's something they don't understand or don't know the answer to, that they refer those callers into us at the Radon Information Center, where we have more extensive training and knowledge.
Okay. And you earlier said that you can go to the health department and get one for $10. Is that all the health departments?
Each county can set their own price. Some counties do opt to give them away for no charge. But we found that the rate of return is greater if there's a little bit of investment on the part of the buyer for it. You know, most are just charging, what they need to recover the cost, because we're not in the business of making money. So, $9, that's a pretty fair price to pay. And I do know that there are some test kits that you can get at the big box stores hardware stores where their maybe shelf price is comparable to $9. It might be like $9.95. But that does not include the cost of analysis once the kit is mailed to the laboratory. So what you'll see in those big box store kits is kind of like this hidden charge that says include a fee to get your test results.
Okay. Well, that's...
So our test kits that we sell here at Marathon County are $9. It includes the cost of the test kit, the cost of analysis. The only additional cost that they pay is the cost of postage to mail the test kit to the lab in Texas.
Okay. Well, that's really good to know. So I've taken the test. I have radon. What changes do then I need to make in my home?
Well, you know, we never base our decision to put in a mitigation system on only one single test. So if you're in that range of 4 to 8 with a short-term test, you would be a candidate for what we call a long-term test. So finding it between 4 and 8 on your first test, you do some additional testing. Also, if you have a short-term result that's greater than 8, we ask you to confirm it with a second test just to make sure that there was nothing wrong with the initial test kit. Okay, we're confirming that. Once you've got your two results, then it's safe to go ahead and look up or we'll provide you with a list of the certified radon mitigation contractors that service your area. And you reach out, you know, it's advisable, always contact, you know, maybe more than one, get a couple quotes, being a good consumer. And select somebody. And we have very, very good contractors that work in our area. And, you know, we're lucky to have them.
Sure. We're talking with Michelle Schwach. She is an environmental health sanitarian with Marathon County Health Department. Do you have any questions about radon? Open lines. Give us a call. 800-642-1234. Or, of course, you can send an email to talk@wpr.org. And this is a Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau. Make sure you stay with us because we're going to continue talking about air and breathing with Dr. Jonathan Tempe. He's going to be talking about respiratory viruses, of which there's a lot going around. But right now we are talking about radon. If you've got any questions, please give us a call, 800-642-1234. So if you do have to go and get a radon mitigation contractor, what kind of money are we talking about? I know it's hard to guess, but can you kind of give us a round figure?
Yeah. The mitigation, of course, the cost of the mitigation systems has increased with inflation. Back pre-COVID, they used to say the range was $800 to $1,200, but I just talked with someone recently that said they recorded a price of $1,500. So it has increased just like everything else has. But, you know, the nice thing is that the contractors can pretty much guarantee they can get the levels down below a 4, which is really what the EPA's action limit is for radon.
Mm-hmm.
Most times they can get the levels even down below 2, which is even better.
And what are some of the things that they will do?
Okay, so part of a mitigation system is not only just the installation of the piping and the installation of the fan that creates the suction in the soil below the home and expels it outside so it's not drawn into the home. They will also do some sealing of cracks and openings where radon is penetrating the walls and floors of your basement or your slab. You know, they're not going to rip out a finished basement to get to those cracks. But anything that's accessible, they're going to try to seal that up. So that is part of the installation. And then after the installation, they should be providing the consumer with a test kit that is put in place and run for a couple of days to check to make sure that the radon levels indeed are well below 4.
Okay. And then how often should you retest for radon once you've had that mitigation?
The protocol is to test every couple of years, to just get a test kit, put it in the basement. I know Isaac earlier, one of the callers, had referred to one of these monitoring systems that you can just kind of plug into the wall and it'll give you a reading of what your radon levels are. You know, that's fine. There's a little bit of controversy over how the accuracy over time on those units, but you can just get another test and put that in place and check it every couple of years.
Okay. Mary in Madison has a question. Go ahead, Mary.
Hi, I was just wondering if you have any suggestions for renting a house with, in case you ended up having high radon levels, what to do if there's no mitigation system in place, and how to handle it as a renter if you're a long-term renter of a house.
So that's a great question, and it does get very tricky because it's not, remember, radon isn't regulated in the state of Wisconsin. So that leaves you with very little teeth to go back to your landlord with. But what I would recommend is, one, reach out to your landlord and say, hey, I did a radon test, and here's what it came back at. The EPA's action limit is 4.0, and this level is well above that. Can I ask you to look into it further? You know, some are great landlords, and they're going to say, wow, I didn't know anything about radon. Thanks for educating me. And the next one's going to, like, turn around and walk away and, like, not want to deal with it, right? That's the reality of the renting world. But what it does is it empowers you as an individual and the one who makes a choice over where you live to be able to say, hey, I'm not willing to live with this, and if the landlord's not going to do anything, then I'm going to move.
Okay. Does that answer your question, Mary?
That does. I really appreciate it.
Okay,
thanks so much.
Okay, wonderful. Thank you for calling.
We
were talking about the companies that do mitigation. How do you know you're going to find someone that's on the level?
Right. So the state website, which is www.lowradon.org. Again, that's lowradon.org, O-R-G.
Mm-hmm. We have a link of that on our website, too. So
yeah. So if you go to that website, it'll tell you there'll be a link on there on how to find both a measurement and a mitigation contractor. The ones that are listed, they are certified. They have gone through the rigorous training and have demonstrated knowledge on a written exam. They have to maintain continuing education credits, all to remain certified to be on this list.
Okay.
So, yeah.
All right. So what about if you're building a new home? Are there things that you can do to prevent problems with radon?
Yeah, it's called radon-resistant new construction.
Oh, nice.
And good question. So, you know, it's something that you really need to have a conversation with your contractor about and really kind of saying, hey, I know I'm in an area of the state that has, you know, a prevalence of radon, and I'd like to take some actions up front. And can we incorporate some of these building nuances to prevent it from being an issue in my home? So basically what they do is they're installing a system, but it's called a passive system. And they put the pipes in, the system is kind of hidden in a wall, the fan unit runs in, and it goes in the attic space of the home. With a passive system, no fan is added until you get into your home and you test it. And if you find out you've got a radon concern, you go up in the attic space, you cut the pipe off, you install a fan, plug it in, and away you go.
Oh, okay. Well, that doesn't seem too difficult.
No. And, it's been a long battle because radon not being regulated with trying to get contractors on board with building homes right away with the radon-resistant new construction. It costs about the same to do it up front at the time you're building the home as it does to, fix the problem later.
Mm-hmm. Now, the fans, the pipes that pump out the radon, they're usually at the roof, I'm assuming, so they're not going to affect any pets or people.
Right. So on an existing home, when they put in a mitigation system, the fan that runs cannot be in the living envelope of the house. So that means the fan needs to either go outside, it needs to go into an attached garage, or it needs to go into the attic space of the home. Those fans have moving parts and create vibration, and you can loosen up the connections over time, and you would never want that fan in your living envelope of your home because you would be mining the radon gas from the ground right into your basement or into your living space.
Sure, sure. And then, like I said, they go out the roof usually?
Yes. Okay. The termination port or the discharge point for a radon mitigation system must terminate below or above the lowest eave of the house. So what we want to do is we want to get it up into the prevailing winds, get it up there, and let dilution do its job.
Mm-hmm. Because it's a problem when it's concentrated.
Right. So okay. We never want to see like that discharge point, let's say, end up right below a bedroom window.
Right.
You would never want that because now you would be pulling that radon gas right into your home.
Sure.
You want that pipe to terminate above the roof line so that the prevailing winds carry it away and dilute it.
Okay. Now, you had mentioned earlier that you're part of the state, which is the northeast area, right?
Yes.
You have a higher prevalence there. What are some of the other areas of the state that may also have that?
I think we have a higher concentration. We know that 2 out of 3 tests that have been conducted in our area and surrounding counties are coming back elevated for radon.
Mm-hmm.
But across the state, the estimation is 1 out of 10 tests are elevated. So, you know, we are a hot spot. The only way to really know if you've got a radon concern or not is to test.
Okay.
We need to test.
And how can your local Radon Information Center help you out? What do you offer?
We are the ones that are purchasing and distributing test kits out to the county. We offer guidance on, how to run your test, where to place it, what level of your home is the appropriate level to test, and then helping with interpreting what do the results mean, what are they telling us, and how, we're here to supply resources. We have some printed materials, online resources, and, how even sometimes a do-it-yourselfer. We don't always encourage that, but if you have somebody who has a really strong mechanical background, they may be able to install a system themselves, and we can even help guide that process.
Oh, that's wonderful. What if you have like a really low level of radon in your home? Is it dangerous? Should you do anything?
Well, any level of radon is dangerous, right? But everything we do has a risk to it. So sometimes I say driving down Grand Avenue here in Wausau has a risk to it.
Very true. Very okay. True.
Yep. So, what the EPA set their action limit at 4.0, that was the level that they felt that the contractors were able to get the radon levels down below and still have minimal risk of developing long-term lung cancer. So if your levels are low in your home, the advice is just to test it every couple of years, put a test kit in, make sure it stayed low, because we do change things over time with our home. For example, homes, as they settle, they develop new cracks. We've all heard our house settle and
sure.
Crack and bang, especially through the winter time. But there are certain things that we do as homeowners that change the way the house breathes and can affect the indoor radon level. For example, let's say you put new windows in where you had drafty windows before. That changes the way your house breathes. You put a new furnace in, a new high-efficiency furnace. That's going to change things.
Oh, sure, sure. And that's the music, so I'm going to have to cut you off, Michelle. I'm really, really sorry. But we really appreciate you coming in and giving us this information. We will definitely check back with you.
Sounds great. Thanks for having me.
You bet. We've been talking with Michelle Schwack. She is an environmental health sanitarian with the Marathon County Health Department. Thank you very much for listening. We'll be back to talk to a doctor about respiratory viruses.
Coming up on...
This is the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Joan Ledoux. Thanks for joining us on WPR News. We're talking about how to avoid serious respiratory illnesses this winter, and we're happy to have Dr. Jonathan Tempe with us for the rest of the show. He's the Associate Dean for Public Health and Community Engagement at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. And one of his specialties is respiratory viruses. And of course, we want to hear from you. Are you dealing with a respiratory illness? How can the doctor help? Give us a call, 800-642-1234, or you can send an email to talk@wpr.org. Dr. Tempe, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you so much, Jill, and good afternoon, and wishing a happy Lunar New Year to all of your listeners.
Yes, that's kind of nice to celebrate twice. And ironically, Larry's not here today because he has a respiratory illness. And I'm sure that you've been seeing a lot of that this year, haven't you?
We have indeed. And I would argue that we're kind of near the peak of what we're going to be seeing for the year. And the reference to the Lunar New Year, oftentimes our peak of influenza and RSV and other viruses coincide with that later New Year's that we celebrate.
Okay, well, it's good to know. I guess I hadn't thought about that. Do you know why?
Respiratory viruses really like people congregated indoors. And so every year in Wisconsin, one of the things we see is as soon as our school year starts in early September, almost without fail, a week later, we see an increase and a dramatic increase in respiratory visits in our primary care and urgent cares. And that kind of continues on. But the other factor is as we get colder, it creates situations in which the viruses really transmit much better. So if we look over a long, long period in Wisconsin, we can see that when our average temperature drops below freezing, we see a significant increase in influenza. And conversely, when we drop out of freezing, for example, like today, we see influenza tend to go away. But so the viruses like congregation, they like cold, dry air for transmission.
Oh, I didn't realize that. Now, the Wisconsin Department of Health keeps track of the viruses based on emergency department visits. And their website says that flu activity is very high and RSV activity is high. Now, how common is it to see these levels as high as they are right now?
We are in a pretty typical year right now, meaning that we're seeing high levels. We're not seeing extraordinarily high levels. And every year is a little bit different based on the strain of influenza we see circulating. It depends on many other factors. So for example, early after the peak of our pandemic, we had 2 years in which people really hadn't had much exposure to respiratory viruses outside of COVID. And then all of a sudden, things hit really hard. If you remember the twin or the triple demic back a couple of years ago, and we saw influenza hit extremely early. And right now, we're seeing things kind of revert back to where things were prior to that pandemic.
Is there any research going on as to why that happened with the tridemic?
Well, every year, a good number of us come down with various virus illnesses. And in the wake, if we survive, and most of us do, we generate some immunity toward what's been going on. But that immunity tends to be short-lived. And if we go 2 or 3 years without having anything, then all of a sudden, we tend to get sicker when we do. The best example I can give you is for new parents who have a child going to daycare for the first time. And they may have gone for several years without any serious infections. And then all of a sudden, with their child in daycare being exposed, they get sick for the first couple of years, almost reliably all winter long.
Yes, I've seen that with a lot of my friends who have contact with a lot of the youngsters. They do tend to spread it, don't they?
Absolutely.
Yeah. So we've been talking about this term respiratory virus. What's actually are the symptoms of a respiratory virus?
almost all of the viruses do very similar things. So they give us runny noses, nasal congestion, sometimes a sore throat. And then we also see that they can affect our breathing. And so we generate cough, some people with wheezing. And if we have underlying breathing problems such as asthma or COPD, the term we use for chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, we can find those conditions being worsened and people having more difficulty breathing. Along with those respiratory symptoms, we also will see fevers sometimes, aches, tiredness, lack of appetite, and so on. And after working with these viruses for years and years and years, I can tell you that it's really difficult to know what somebody has just by looking at the symptoms alone, because there's a great deal of overlap. And so it really helps us to know both the symptoms and what is in circulation at the time. And that can help us be better clinicians.
So when should someone seek your advice, or, you know, a health official's advice on what they have? When is time to go to check it out?
Well, I always say that when we have really significant symptoms, so if we're having difficulty breathing, if we're having a high fever that just is not relenting with acetaminophen or with ibuprofen, if for any reason we're feeling uncomfortable with how we feel, how a family member feels, how a child feels, those are all good reasons to come in and be seen. Occasionally we'll see people with sore throats bad enough where they're not swallowing well. Sometimes we'll see people with significant dizziness and so on. And those are all things that might prompt us to come on in. But, you know, if I step back and put on my hat as a family physician, I will say anything that worries you, give us a call and we can help you determine whether or not you need to be seen.
Oh, that's great advice. And I think we probably know this answer to this question, but maybe we don't. How are respiratory viruses spread?
They're spread from one of us to the next. And most of them are spread by what we term respiratory droplets. And these are small liquid particles that come out of our nose and mouth when we cough or sneeze. In some instances, viruses can be transmitted through aerosols, which are even smaller particles. And there are studies out there that have shown that simply talking or singing when you have COVID can transmit to other people. If I go back in my memory to our most transmissible virus, measles, that one is notorious for aerosol spread and can hang in the air for a long time. So a person can be in an airspace such as a waiting room in a clinic and be gone, and half an hour later, somebody can come in and contract measles. So this is why we take things like measles very, very seriously.
And of course, we got used to, you know, most of us wearing masks during COVID. Is that a good idea even now when you're not feeling well?
Absolutely. A mask will first and foremost catch anything that you're unable to block with your hand or your elbow. So when you cough and sneeze, that mask can capture many of those respiratory droplets. Maybe not all of them, but it really reduces the likelihood of transmitting to the next person. Conversely, if you're somebody who is really interested in avoiding getting infected, and in particular, people with underlying medical conditions or people with immunocompromise, that wearing a mask can provide a lot of additional benefit. Also, staying away from crowded areas, staying away from people who are coughing and sneezing, good idea as well.
Okay, sounds good. Vernon Eau Claire County called. He's wondering about influenza A, how long before it's not transmittable, and after you've contracted it, and is influenza A a virus or a bacteria?
Well, influenza A is a virus, and it comes in two different flavors, basically. There's influenza A H3 and H1, and this describes proteins on the surface of that virus. And there's also an influenza B, and if we're going to be complete, we also have to worry about influenza A H5, and that's the one that we're seeing in dairy cows and in poultry. But these are all viruses, and the influenza A that normally affects people and influenza B, both are easily transmitted over about the first 5 days of symptoms. And so from the time you're exposed until you develop symptoms is usually between 24 hours and 3 days. And you have the worst of your symptoms at about day number two of symptoms, when you have high fever, you can have cough, you can have aches and so on. And then the symptoms gradually go away over the next 2 or 3 days. So a 5 day course is pretty typical. And after 5 days, we have a hard time isolating virus from people's noses and throats. So I usually tell patients to stay away from especially vulnerable people for those first 5 days.
Okay. And we've got a question from John in Plover. Go ahead, John.
Yes. I'm 61 years old, and several years ago, I was diagnosed with latent TB. And I'm concerned, is that it could it turn into active TB? How concerned should I be? And I, by the way, I did take the 6 month regimen of antibiotics, the recommended antibiotics. I don't recall the name when that happened.
Okay, thank you, John.
That's fantastic. You took the medications and were adherent for that 6 month course. Well, latent TB indicates that you were exposed to tuberculosis at one point in your life. And what we know is over the lifespan of people who have latent TB, about 1 in 10 will go on to develop active tuberculosis. By going on that medication for the 6 months, that reduces the likelihood by about 90 to 95%. So tuberculosis doesn't tend to be a seasonal infection. It tends to be more one that we get when we're exposed to other individuals with tuberculosis. And if you're paying attention to the news, there's a big outbreak in Kansas right now. Fortunately, in Wisconsin, we see sporadic cases, but we haven't seen any big clusters at all. But again, I think the take home here is latent TB indicates you've been exposed, but you haven't developed the active TB. And the best thing we can do for that is put you on that prophylactic medication that will lower the risk for the rest of your life.
Okay, thanks for that question, John. We're talking with Dr. Jonathan Tempty. He is an Associate Dean for Public Health and Community Engagement at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. And one of his specialties is respiratory viruses. Do you have questions? Please give us a call, 800-642-1234, or you can send an email to talk@wpr.org. And this is a Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Najel. Just a reminder, our first book club selection is about a month away, and we're reading The Snowbirds by Christina Clancy. And the book follows a married couple who've hit a rough patch, and then the husband goes missing. I hope you'll all read along for what's sure to be a thrilling mystery and an honest look at marriage. Again, that's coming up at the end of February, so you still have plenty of time to get it. Right now, we are talking about respiratory viruses and your health. And so please give us a call if you have a question, 800-642-1234. Dr. Tempty, we had an email from Dennis. He says as his allergies increases his nasal discharge, this is probably to flush particles and possibly microbes. Though excessive discharges is inconvenient, does it benefit the body, or does the sputum accommodate more microbes than it expels?
Well, I think there's a purpose for us to produce a lot of mucus, and in general, it helps to clear things out. On the other hand, one of the side effects we have from this extra mucus production is plugging up various cavities in our bodies, such as our sinus cavities. And if they're not draining well, we have this wonderful liquid with a lot of protein in it that is nice and warm at body temperature and can sometimes make a good environment for bacteria to live in. And so we see at some level, people with a respiratory virus infection and that nasal discharge, then developing what we call an acute sinusitis, which is typically a bacterial infection. And so by and large, if we try and reduce the amount of discharge, we typically don't slow down the process of clearing the infection. We're largely relying on our immune system to do that. So I think whereas we don't have great evidence that any of those over-the-counter medications will cure a disease, sometimes they do help us to feel better. I hope that answers your question, Dennis.
I believe it did. Thank you. So what advice, are some of the immunizations that are available that might help us out with this? And is it too late to get them?
So the second part of your question I'll answer first. And the answer is no, it's not too late. And early on, I said, I thought we were pretty close to being at peak of influenza right now. That means we still have at least half of the cases yet to come. And so if we can prevent those, all the better. Now, if I take a step back, we have a number of vaccines out there that are aimed at respiratory infections. And there are three that are aimed at viruses. So influenza, the COVID-19 vaccine, and the RSV or respiratory syncytial virus. We also have a couple other vaccines aimed at other bacteria that cause respiratory infections. So one is the Tdap vaccine, which stands for tetanus, diphtheria, and the respiratory component pertussis or whooping cough. And then the last one is a pneumococcal vaccine. These are all aimed at people of different ages, sometimes with underlying medical conditions. But let me just divert right now to the influenza vaccine and the COVID-19. Both of these are recommended for everybody 6 months age and older, and are recommended if you've had them before on a once-a-year basis. If you're over 65, you're eligible for a second COVID vaccine 6 months after the first. And if you're immunocompromised, you're eligible for even more additional doses just to provide that protection. But these are really wonderful preventive tools. And I'll say they're vastly underused in Wisconsin right now. Latest data I have is only about 1 in 3 of us have received the flu vaccine. Of the people eligible for the RSV vaccine, only 1 in 5. And of the COVID vaccine, only 1 in 6 of us have received that vaccine this year. So we have a long way to go to try and become better protected.
Okay. I've got 2 of those. I was not offered RSV. Who's supposed to be getting those? That?
Well, Jill, you're far too young for that. Now, we routinely recommend RSV vaccines for individuals age 75 and older, and for people who are age 60 to 74 who have some significant underlying medical conditions. And the last caveat I will throw out is a very small segment of our population who are younger are eligible for RSV, and these are women who are pregnant. But we give that vaccine over a pretty limited time during pregnancy, from 32 through 36 weeks of gestation. And after tomorrow, we're going to say we don't need to do that until next year. It's a time-limited vaccine. We typically do it between September and the end of January. But that's a vaccine that will protect the mother, but more importantly, it'll protect the developing fetus, because when that infant is born, they're pre-equipped with immunity for RSV, and RSV is terrible for infants. Every year, anywhere from 2 to 3% of children or infants are hospitalized for RSV, and we can prevent that through vaccine or through a new injection for infants.
And what are the symptoms of RSV? How are they different than the regular flu or COVID?
Yeah, well, RSV is really interesting because we can get it over and over throughout our life. We don't tend to develop much immunity toward it. And more than anything, for older people, and so school-aged children and adults, it's that really nasally cold that we get in the wintertime. With a great deal, I'm thinking back to Dennis, who had called in, but it's the one that produces a great deal of nasal mucus. We're constantly blowing. When I'm seeing young children in the clinic, I usually refer to the characteristic sign as the green 11, because they have two streaks coming out of their nose.
You, let me say you.
Yeah,
okay.
Exactly. But RSV really is terrible for very small people because it produces a great deal of mucus, and that mucus coats their airways. And because of that, they have real difficulty breathing. And so just a quick anecdote, the day that I made a visit for the residency program that I eventually joined here in Madison, went out for lunch with one of the residents who was currently in. He had been up all night, and he'd put 17 infants into the hospital overnight with RSV. And so that's the type of thing that we can see. And we don't have any treatments for this. After you have it, we don't have any good evidence-based interventions other than supportive care. So now we have a vaccine we can give to mothers to protect the infant after the infant's born. And we also have not a vaccine, but a monoclonal antibody. So a special chemical or a special antibody that we can inject is very safe, and it'll protect that infant for the next 6 months of life. So this will give them the protection during the entire RSV season.
Oh, that's wonderful. And I'm assuming pediatricians offer that readily?
Yeah, absolutely. We would love it if more of our birthing hospitals, you know, places where people actually give birth, would provide that to the newborns, especially, you know, day one or two. But as it turns out, most of the monoclonal antibody is being provided in outpatient clinics, either pediatrician or family practice offices.
Okay, well, we have a question about RSV with Ruth from Chippewa Falls. Go ahead, Ruth.
Hello. I want to know if I have to get that RSV every year.
That's a great question, Ruth. And right now, this vaccine is licensed for a one-time administration. And we know it was licensed about a year and a half ago. So what we're learning is coming from not only our experience with people who have received this vaccine, but from the clinical trials done by the pharmaceutical companies prior to that vaccine being out to the public. And what we know right now is it's providing protection for at least 3 years, and it may provide protection up to 5 years, but we don't have any evidence or any recommendation right now for revaccination. So that's something we're waiting to hear about. And we'll try and let people know ASAP once we do. I kind of anticipate we'll probably be on a 5-year schedule for older adults with that vaccine when everything is said and done.
Okay, great. Thanks, Ruth. Appreciate that call. Deb emailed us, and she says, we've heard for years about viruses and colds spreading in cold, dry conditions, especially if people are congregating. And aside from congregating, don't southern hemisphere areas with warm, moist temperatures still have cold and flu seasons?
That is a wonderful question.
We have great listeners. They're so smart.
from an epidemiological standpoint. And in fact, it's really interesting that here in Wisconsin, we're northern temperate climate. We have four distinct seasons or even more, depending on who you talk to. And likewise, if we look at countries like Australia, New Zealand, South Africa, Chile, Argentina, they have very similar influenza seasons and respiratory virus seasons. However, they're offset by 6 months. They correspond to the Southern Hemisphere winter. Now, what gets really interesting is if when we get into those countries that form the middle section of our globe, you know, the subtropical and tropical areas, and we see respiratory virus season more affiliated with monsoon, when there's a lot of rain and people are congregating indoors, but you don't see quite the same really distinct peaks that we see up here in the higher latitudes. So it's a great question, and it really speaks to how important congregation is for respiratory virus spread.
So, and let's get into prevention a little bit here. Other than, you know, try to stay out of crowds this time of year, what else are some of the other things that we should be doing?
Well, I think good hand washing is really important. I can't tell you the number of times I've been at an airport and watching a child walking alongside the human conveyor belt and putting their hand up on the black railing. And they've just been rubbing the nose, and you can watch that streak come out. And then you watch the next person come along, run their hand over that. And if, you know, the child has something contagious, watching a person rub their nose or their eye can allow that transmission. So good hand washing is really important. And I'll just put a plug in for one of our other viruses out there, the stomach flu or norovirus that's been in the news a lot. And noroviruses are really spread oftentimes by hand, and hand washing is really important. With things like norovirus, soap and water work. Hand gel, hand sanitizer doesn't work very well. The hand sanitizer does work pretty well for COVID, for influenza, and RSV, but you have to just kind of keep that in mind. But good hand washing, watching out for those crowds. And then, you know, as we've already talked about, being vaccinated, really important keys to keeping yourself healthy.
Now, when we say good hand washing, could you describe what that is? I think we've heard a lot about it when COVID was so rampant and we were so good at it. But I think we may be forgotten. So could you go over that?
Well, and I'm guilty of this too, because oftentimes you find yourself hands under the water for 2 seconds, shake them off, dry them off. For respiratory virus protection, and especially things like the norovirus, which is more of a stomach or an intestinal infection, hand washing with soap and water and for 20 to 30 seconds is useful. We often tell people to sing the happy birthday song or Old MacDonald, depending on your predilection. But that can just help you pace that a little bit longer.
And if you're in a public restroom and sing it out loud, just be realize that people are going to stare at you, right?
Exactly.
We were earlier talking to someone about air purifying and as related to allergens. Is that something that will also help with viruses that are in the air?
It's a good question. And I would say the evidence is sketchy. Okay. We know that there have been some large studies looking at schools. And what we find is not a great deal of difference between schools with big, heavy-duty HVAC systems and HEPA filters and schools without. On a more local basis, however, we do find that air purification can really reduce the droplets that are spread in the air column and theoretically should have some benefit there. So I wish I could tell you that there's really good evidence. On the other hand, at my clinic and many other clinics, we do have an isolation room with negative air movement. And so those are rooms that if we have a patient with tuberculosis or if we had a patient with suspected measles, they would go in this negative airflow room. And all that means is the air does not come out of the door. The air gets sucked under the door, or when I open the door, it gets pulled in and out through the roof. And that can be very, very beneficial. I'll just give you another little tidbit here that some of my colleagues that we've worked closely with in our research do a lot of work with air sampling for surveillance. And we've done a lot of work within schools and in conjunction with their work. And what we can show is when I see children who have influenza or COVID in the same school, they're able to detect the genetic product of that virus by simply sucking air through a filter. And it doesn't mean that there's infectious viruses out there, but we're pulling enough air to detect the virus from the people around. So the take-home message is viruses can be, first of all, they're incredibly small. And when we cough and sneeze, we're not putting out tens or hundreds, we're putting out millions and tens of millions of virus. And happening to walk through a cloud that's just been coughed or sneezed out is a really good way to contract that pathogen.
Yes. Well, what about humidifiers? Do they help at all in the home?
Well, I think they do. And I'm not sure if they help clear the air, but having your tissue in your nose and the back of your throat being less dry, less cracked and so on, probably provides a little bit of protection from invading pathogens. So I think one of the things that really happens in Wisconsin, and we all know this happened during the last week when we had those really cold temperatures, our skin dries out, we get very itchy, our mucous membranes dry out. And what we can do is form gaps in the surface and have less of that protective mucus that we talked about, and it can be a ready entry for those viruses.
So get those humidifiers going and keep the filters clean, right?
Exactly.
We're talking to Dr. Jonathan Tempe. He is an Associate Dean for Public Health and Community Engagement at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. What questions do you have for him? Have you been suffering? Do you need some help? Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234, or you can send an email to talk@wpr.org. This is a Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau. I hope you can join us again tomorrow on Garden Talk. We'll cover the plants that earned the Green Thumb Award this year, and you'll also hear more about straw bale gardening and, of course, find out everything you've wanted to know about ferns. That starts at 11, or if you're an early riser, you can catch it again on Saturday morning at 5 a.m. Right now, we're talking about respiratory viruses. And Dr. Tempe, let's say that someone in your family starts showing symptoms of respiratory viruses. Generally, what can we do to try to avoid catching it? I mean, we're probably going to, but what can we do?
Well, a couple thoughts out there. Number one is we do have treatments for influenza and for COVID-19. There are antivirals that can be used for the appropriate people, but with a caveat, they have to be started really early. For influenza, in the first 48 hours after the first symptom. With COVID, about 5 days after that first symptom. But we also know that early treatment with an antiviral can sometimes reduce the likelihood of transmission. Our team did a study in long-term care centers and nursing homes a few years back, and we showed that with early detection and early use of antivirals for prophylaxis, we prevented a significant number of hospitalizations and emergency room visits. So taking a step back, I would say that having suspicion, you know, if somebody suddenly changes, thinking about testing, and we now have over-the-counter tests for both influenza and for COVID-19. We have better tests available in urgent cares and doctor's offices and so on. But understanding what you have can be helpful. With any respiratory virus, and I don't care which one it is, that removing a person away from vulnerable people, newborns and so on, can really reduce the likelihood of transmission. Using good hand washing, as we talked about, using a mask when we can't be isolated from each other can be beneficial. And then just kind of remembering some basics about time. So the longer after that first symptom, the less likely you are to transmit. And again, with influenza, about 5 days. With COVID, about 7 days. RSV, about 8 days after that first symptom, you're far less likely to transmit to somebody. So kind of keeping, if you just want to make it real simple, saying 5 to 7 days after onset, your likelihood goes down.
Okay.
But all those other good things in between.
All right. Jeff in Eau Claire, you have a question. Go right ahead.
Yes. My wife, about a year and a half ago, received the RSV vaccination. And then maybe 2 weeks later, someone after began losing vision, we ended up seeing a lot of different medical folks. And it turned out her immune system attacked both the optic nerve and then the nerves of her legs. And ultimately, it was diagnosed Guillain-Barré, if I'm pronouncing that correctly. So in subsequent medical treatment, it's been said that the RSV vaccination in a small percentage of folks has motivated the Guillain-Barré. I think it surfaced in clinical trials and then since then a little bit. And so just wondering if you know anything about it. I will add that my wife had the latent TB, so that had she gotten RSV, it would have been very not a good situation. So she doesn't regret having the vaccination, but it's been a year of prednisone. It's been quite a journey to try it. So anyway, the knowledge between RSV vaccination and immune response, possibly Guillain-Barré. Thanks.
Yes, Jeff, that is a wonderful point to make. And I'm hoping that your wife is recovering from the Guillain-Barré syndrome, because that can be pretty, pretty awful. Well, I have to confess, I was pulled onto the CDC's adult RSV vaccine work group as a safety consultant. This is something I've done for a long time. And in the early clinical trials from the manufacturers, there was a concern about Guillain-Barré syndrome, which is an acquired paralysis. It, as you mentioned, is activating your immune system, and the immune system can then attack parts of your spinal cord and produce some paralysis going on. And so that's a really significant. And this is something that from day one, we have been following very, very carefully. There have been reports put out about the cautions out there. And the FDA has recently put a warning on in terms of Guillain-Barré. The good news is this is a very rare event, but it does happen. So in the spirit of transparency, FDA, CDC, and others that are putting the vaccine out there will put that out and give that warning to doctors. Where this is important for patients is that if you have ever had Guillain-Barré syndrome in the past, you probably should avoid the RSV vaccine. But I think this is my chance to put a plug in that any adverse event is taken very, very seriously by the U.S. Advisory Committee on Immunization Practice, the work groups that help out with that, the CDC, FDA, and by clinicians like myself and my fellow family physicians and pediatricians and internal medicine doctors that vaccinate. We're really concerned about that. What's really important, Jeff, is that when these things happen, we also go out of our way to make sure we report them to the reporting system. There's a vaccine adverse event reporting system called VAERS, V-A-E-R-S. And if you just type that into Google, it can come up. But it allows anybody from patients and regular people to pharmacists and doctors and nurse practitioners to put reports in. And these tend to be followed up then by the vaccine safety groups.
Great. Thank you for that question, Jeff, and best of luck to you. Elaine in Janesville, it's your turn. Go right ahead.
Hi, I'm calling in regards to this, whatever it is that's going on. I've had it for going on 6 weeks. It comes and goes. I got nasal congestion, headaches, body aches, lack of wanting to eat anything, cough, chills, you name it, I get it. I was doing normal stuff that I normally do when I get anything going on, and it seemed to improve after about 10 days. But it got better for 3 or 4 days, and then I turned around and got right back again where I started from. This time I went to the doctors. They done tests. They said they couldn't find nothing to explain it.
Yeah, well, Elaine, you're describing something we see not infrequently. My first thought is that most respiratory viral illnesses are self-limited. And over a six-week period, it's possible to have two or three different infections coming on. Occasionally, when we're testing our research patients, what we'll find is sometimes they have up to three different viruses that we detect at the same time. It's probably only one that's causing their syndrome, but they're carrying along the remnants of a previous infection. The other thing that could be happening is one of our current viruses, called human metapneumovirus, is the one that tends to produce really, really long syndromes lasting 4 and 5 weeks. And so it's possible that you could have this case up and down. The third thing I think about is something that we call double sickening, is when people come down with an infection, they feel bad, then they start feeling better, and then they get sick again. And those can be suggestive of a sinus infection, sometimes a pneumonia that follow on the tail end of a respiratory infection. So I think all those are out there. It sounds like your doctors are doing a good job of checking things over, making sure you don't have a pneumonia and so on. And I think that the bottom line is we just kind of have to ride that out and get through that. The last thing I'll mention, though, is with things like COVID-19, about 1 in 10 people will develop the long COVID syndrome. And that can be really devastating for some people. It doesn't sound like you have any of the symptoms of that. But we do know that vaccination will prevent long COVID. And even we now know that people who get reinfected multiple times with COVID tend to have a higher risk for long COVID, and vaccination can help prevent that.
Okay, good luck, Elaine. I hope that things work out for you. Dr. Tempty, Jeff in Eau Claire wanted to follow up. He was the one whose wife had the reaction, to mention that her case is extremely rare, 8 out of 1 million people. So thank you, Jeff.
Yeah, and Jeff, thanks for that comment, because in fact, that's what the level is that we are tracking. It's about 1 in 100,000 or 1 in 200,000 vaccinees. The other thing I'll just mention is that in general, in the vaccine world, that when we see a real significant or worrisome outcome, the tolerance for that typically is less than 1 in 1 million. So the vaccines you see disappear are vaccines that have the significant adverse events that are rare but are significant. And we just have very, very low tolerance for that within the vaccine world.
Okay, thanks again for calling back, Jeff. Wayne from San Francisco Bay Area emailed us. Would you please comment on the effectiveness of zinc lozenges to reduce the symptoms and disease course of respiratory infections?
Yeah, interesting question, and it comes with a caveat. There's not a great deal of good evidence out there from randomized controlled trials to show that zinc lozenges do much. There is some evidence out there that people who, there was a time that they had swabs that people would stick in their noses. And unfortunately, there are a number of people who lost their sense of smell from that. So it can be an adverse event. I don't think you'll get that from the lozenges at all. But again, there's a whole history of various products out there, from supplements, vitamin C, echinacea, and so on. And they have either no or just marginal effect. So at the end of the day, kind of like I mentioned with over-the-counter treatments for cold and flu, if they make you feel better, that can be reasonable. If they're not making you feel better at all, they're just helping to drain your wallet. So let the buyer beware.
Okay, thank you very much for that, Wayne. Speaking of, okay, so I'm sure there's plenty of people out there listening right now that are suffering from one of these viruses that we've been talked about. What would you suggest they do to make themselves feel more comfortable and maybe quicker?
Well, I think this goes without saying for all of us. The getting good sleep, getting good nutrition, and even, you know, maintaining some level of exercise, even when you're feeling a little bit ill, can be helpful. When the sun is shining, you know, getting outside as able. And then some of the over-the-counter products can help you feel a little bit better. And again, I think we've talked about things that might help dry out the mucous membranes a little bit. So about the only decongestant we can get anymore is pseudoephedrine, which is now kind of behind the pharmacy desk. For some people who have allergic components, antihistamines can be beneficial. And we have both the antihistamines that are sedating. So maybe if you want to sleep, that can help you. Or non-sedating if you have to be awake and going through work. And I think the other thing is just really good hydration, making sure you're keeping up with the fluids, because anytime you're either febrile, you're breathing more heavily, you can lose water that you're not aware of. So hydration can help you, and that will help kind of move that mucus out as well. So,
okay. Marty in Lake Geneva has a question. Go ahead, Marty.
Thanks for taking my call. Dogs get cancer, humans get cancer, dogs get diarrhea, humans get diarrhea. A dog we have has kennel cough. Can that be passed to us? And if so, are there mostly similarities between the two that can transfer to each other? I'll listen to your answer off air. Thank you.
Well, the good news is most viruses are pretty selective to their hosts. So kennel cough is not something that is easily transmittable to humans. You don't have to worry about that. There are some exceptions out there. And early on, I mentioned influenza H5. That's the avian influenza that's affecting our poultry flocks. It has gotten in dairy cattle. It has jumped from dairy cattle through raw milk into cats. And so occasionally you'll see these transfers from species to species, and they can be devastating. So, for example, cats do incredibly poorly, and they die very, very quickly from this virus. So kennel cough is not something we worry about, but it's my plea right now for people out there, because we're having a lot of H5N1, that influenza, in birds. Stay away from dead birds out there, because we do know of cases where it has jumped from a bird to a human.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Temtu. We really appreciate all your expertise today.
You're very welcome. It's been a pleasure. And again, our wishes to Larry to feel better.
I'll pass those on. Thank you. And thank you for joining us today. This and all our shows, of course, are a team effort. Thanks to our producers, Clara Neipert, Joel Patinod, our technical directors, Lee Rayburn and Jeff Robbins, and host Larry Mueller. I'm Jill Nadeau. Thanks for joining us.